All the creatures that live in temperate forests, there's one that's guaranteed to strike fear into the heart of any survivor.
No sudden movements at all. And my heart is thumping. Unbelievable to see it. See a bear this close. Okay, he's just spotted us. He's turning away.
Welcome back to the Talk a Token podcast. I'm Patrick Santino.
And I'm Clifford Vickery.
Awesome. How's it going, Clifford?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. Kind of busy week. How about you?
Yeah. Passed my first exam to become an architect.
Ooh.
It's nice and cold here. It's got me thinking about warm lodges and bears.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So for this episode, we got a couple different things to talk about. I don't know how much we'll actually hit all of them or if we will get to all of them, but we'll talk about the highest levels of annoyance with this narrator. We'll talk about Bjorn, of course. We'll talk about, yeah, lots of in-depth about Bjorn, like his love of his and Tolkien's love of nature. We'll talk about the hospitality tradition throughout myths. Mm-hmm. And finally, we'll talk about Gandalf leaving and what's to come. But before we do that, let's do Cliff's notes.
So, chapter 7, episode 7 of The Hobbit. This chapter was Queer Lodgings. So, the eagles send Bilbo and the dwarves on their way, letting them ride on their backs and flying far to the east. The company is dropped off by a great rock near a river, which we will learn is called Kerak by the Great River. As they continue onwards, Gandalf is rather cagey and secretive in describing the next stop. Eventually they come upon a great estate with giant bees and talking animals, where the host, Bjorn, is a monstrous and gruff man, and he reluctantly allows them into his house. Upon learning their story, though, he feeds them a great feast. They're waited upon by his animals. We learn that Bjorn is a skin changer and goes off into the night in the form of a huge bear to explore. And they see the hobbits and Bilbo see nothing of him nor Gandalf the next day and are treated to bread and honey by the strange animal servants. When Bjorn returns, he reports that he went to verify the truth of their story and in fact found a goblin and a warg scout who revealed that the group is being pursued. Bjorn, quite kind by this point, sends the group on their way with ponies that must be returned at the gates of Mirkwood, the dark and foreboding forest. When they reach the entrance, Gandalf departs along with the ponies and Bjorn's secret protection. What'd you make of this chapter, Patrick?
I thought this was a fun chapter. I remember from the very first time I read it, I thought Bjorn was really cool. I thought their entrance sequence was pretty funny. Mm-hmm. What'd you think?
I agree. Bjorn's probably one of my favorite characters in this book. And the setting, his wilderness estate, I thought is probably one of my favorite places in the story.
Yeah. Let's see. Should we start with this narrator then? Just the one comment that really drove me up a wall.
Sure. So you might be alluding to the narrator jumping into the story as he is wont to do, and talking about some mysterious battle of the five armies. What's with this?
Well, I mean, for anybody that knows the book, okay, he's referencing something that clearly would probably come at the climax of the story, as anybody, even if you're reading it for the first time, could guess. So, I mean, it's like, Tolkien, what are you doing, buddy? Like, this is just ridiculous.
So you think he's intentionally making the story anticlimactic there?
Well, yeah, what are you doing spoiling your own story? I mean, fair. We're working so hard here not to give any spoilers, and you're just doing it yourself. I don't know. So yeah, but like you were saying, like Bjorn's your favorite character so far. That's kind of a pattern, as we've now established, that some new character or location's kind of introduced each chapter, and that's basically the focus of it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
One narrative per chapter. I like it. It fits in the vein of it feeling kind of like a children's book. Like you could imagine each chapter being a bedtime story. Like each chapter is a story in itself.
Mm-hmm.
You get these little bits of adventures.
Yeah, and you can kind of. It wouldn't be that hard to just drop one of these chapters by itself and still continue the story. It wouldn't be that hard to unwrite it and just have them keep moving on.
Which, that's something that I wrestle with a little bit, because it does, that specific thing makes it feel like, it makes the story feel less, like each part feels less intrinsic, you know?
Yeah. Explain more.
Like, if you can cut out these parts, but the story's still there, it feels like it's more of a collection of stories and less, you know, one pure narrative.
Hmm.
Or maybe you could say that that's actually what makes it such a good story, is that it is pretty strong and persistent, even if you were to cut out these individual adventures.
Yeah, I don't know. And this one is kind of weird that it's even memorable, because they were basically sitting at a house the whole time. And that's not even the first time where we just chilled at some house for the first for a whole chapter. We already did that in Rivendell already. Yeah, or at Bilbo's house, even.
Speaking of that, Bjorn was making me think of Elrond a little bit. Bjorn seems like a pretty cool dude, even though he's got all these beastly qualities, like he's this giant, gruff, hairy man. He's also a vegetarian. He literally lives off milk and honey. And similar to Elrond and The Last Homely Home, if we remember, before the Misty Mountains, Bjorn's place seems like a literal paradise in, or an oasis, surrounded by dark, foreboding places. Do you see parallels there?
Yeah, I don't know. Bjorn, we gotta get into his name, but we'll do that in a little bit. Yeah, he's wild. I mean, he seems extremely wild, especially when he's in his bear form or whatnot. Uh-huh. And even when he's a man, he seems, like you said, pretty gruff and not super friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's a vegetarian and is pretty good with nature. One of the books I was reading, and this guy, Joseph Pierce, he always tries to make like any sort of Christian reference that he can along with this. And okay. So he compared him to St. Francis, which I would usually go for that stuff, but like not in this case, because I mean...
And why is he making that comparison? Because Bjorn's sort of like a man among the animals?
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, and one half of him actually is, like that's true, but the other half is the one that, you know, goes down and hunts orcs and wargs and, you know, hangs up their skins.
Mm-hmm.
So
for those of you who haven't read the chapter yet, Bjorn is a... They call him a skin changer in the book. I thought of his being sort of a werewolf or a werebear, you might say. Is that a real thing, or did I make that up?
They were using werebear in like Shippey's books.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he's a werebear, and his human form is kind and basically just a like a meditative homesteader almost. Like he's got this fortress out in the middle of the wild, and he talks to his animals and runs his lodge, and he's kind and respectful, and then at night turns into a monster.
Should we talk about the name now, or should we...
Yeah, yeah, what do we know about Bjorn? What does Tolkien have inspiration for this? Are there references he's drawing on?
Yeah, for sure. This is actually one of his least original characters in all of his mythology, actually, based on the name. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So, with Bjorn, we actually start to finally get to relate to the mythical text that Tolkien probably knew the most about and would have to do, you know, probably spend the most time with of all the stuff that he would ever academically, I don't know, write about.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is what?
Well, you take a guess.
Beowulf?
There we go, dude. There we go. All right. So
if the audience remembers, Tolkien, I believe, was a professor of Anglo-Saxon language and literature. So Beowulf being one of the critical Anglo-Saxon texts, makes sense that Tolkien would be studying it and writing about it all the time.
Yeah, so if you look at Beowulf, the word actually means bear. Did you pick
it? Okay, in Old English?
Well, yeah, but like break it apart, like break up that word. What does it divide into?
Bayo and wolf.
Yeah. Okay. So the wolf, you can hear that, right?
Yeah, certainly.
Okay. So the bayo is the Old English word for bee. So he's the bee wolf or the honey eater.
Oh, interesting. So, like a honey wolf.
Yeah. So
that's pretty cool.
Right. And so they were kind of comparing it to Beowulf in that. Let me see here.
Well, I happen to also know that Bjorn is not even ancient, but it is the modern word for bear in Swedish.
Correct, but
very similar words in other Scandinavian and Germanic languages.
Right, but Bjorn is also the Old English word for man or warrior as well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Does this have to do... I know that I remember hearing a little bit about Vikings, like the berserkers, where they would put on bear skins and probably take some sort of hallucinogenic drugs and get themselves pretty riled up before going into battle. But I know there's sort of like a spiritual connection to becoming an animal. And any thought on this? No? I'm taking it too far?
I mean, I wasn't getting anything from there. I mean, I've heard of that too. Don't know if Tolkien would have actually been drawn on any of that. You can continue to make your case if you want.
Okay, I gotta do some research on it. Give me a second. Yeah, so berserker, if you've heard of these Viking warriors who would... whether it's by consuming some sort of substance or simply through like groupthink, were able to turn themselves, like get themselves in sort of a trance where they'd become, I kind of imagine like however they were doing it, they effectively were on coke and were just like totally riled up before going into battle. And they'd usually go into battle without metal armor on, without wearing mail. And so there's origins describing them as wearing wolf coats, and berserker literally translates as bear shirt. Yeah, and it sounds like there's some confusion as to whether or not there's connections between the word bear, like bare naked, and the word bear, like the animal. But there is certainly a connection there between these warriors and something about bears and going into battle. So that's pretty interesting that you say Bjorn. Were you saying Bjorn is the Old English word for warrior?
Yeah, well, I also got here too. Bjorn, there was a character named Bjorn in some Norse saga thing. There's some mention in the saga of Hrolf Krarki. Don't know if I pronounced that right. But that character was supposed to be... he might have been the exact same person as Beowulf in the Beowulf story. And mm-hmm. Beowulf himself, getting back to him, no, he never turned into a bear throughout the book, but he was always like super wild and gruff and like would tear people's limbs off with his big strength. And he was a good swimmer, which bears usually are too.
Mm-hmm.
So Beowulf himself has comparisons to bear. In this Norse saga, this Bjorn guy, who's the equivalent of Beowulf, actually does turn into a bear, like literally turn into a bear at the final battle.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I don't know, your berserker thing, that's pretty interesting too.
I'm now digging into it a little bit more.
Okay.
And this is open to interpretation because it's like I was saying earlier, it sounds like based on how you do the translations, some people argue that they are more connected to wolves or boars. But if you follow the line of thought that the berserkers are bear warriors, it's believed that a lot of them they drew their power from the bear, and they were devoted to the bear cult, which was once fairly popular in Norse culture and Germanic culture. And so they had a sort of religious connection to bears, and then were also trained to be these epic warriors. And there are different traditions associated with that, like their bodies were laid out in bear skins for funeral rites, and in battle it's said that they would effectively turn into bears or become like bears. And to go berserk was in old Scandinavian languages hamask, which translates as change form or enter a state of wild fury. So you see there is a connection there between the shape-shifting, the fury, becoming the bear, being a bear warrior. It's pretty interesting. I see what you're saying about Bjorn having a pretty robust set of references behind him that Tolkien's pulling from.
Yeah.
Tales from the Norse Legends. The Vikings of Midgard, or Earth, worshipped Odin. And while most were feared warriors in their own right, there grew up among them a special cult of warriors who dedicated their existence to his service. They wore the skins of bears or wolves and lived apart from their fellow men. They were called the Berserks, or Berserkers, and in battle were renowned for their absolute ferocity and total absence of fear. The Berserkers loved the roar of battle and the scent of death, and lived only to fight and kill, wishing only to be killed themselves one day and join Odin among the fallen in Valhalla as a reward for their courage and dedication to their lord. Their normal warrior's job was to protect the Berserker's back, but this could be a doubly dangerous task, as in the heat of a berserk rage, they would often fail to distinguish friend from foe and kill any who came within striking distance. We still use the word berserk today to describe someone who flies into a mad rage.
So we've unpacked Bjorn's wild bear side, his furious warrior side, but of course there's the, what we were saying, could be maybe a St. Francis-like side of him, where he's this vegetarian lodge keeper who speaks with his animals and tends to his honeybees and takes care of his crops and leads this super peaceful life in nature. What about this side of Bjorn? What's Tolkien pulling from? What's he referencing? And also, is it very intentional that this is a sort of a paradise surrounded by darkness?
Well, I think Tolkien's probably just drawn up his own personal beliefs and interests and hobbies.
Okay. So Tolkien himself was maybe a naturalist or a fond of nature in a similar way?
We mentioned before, he grew up in the outskirts and inside, like, basically central Birmingham throughout his childhood. But he always liked it when he was on the outskirts better, and he could, like, walk around, like, the fields and meadows and everything like that.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, throughout his days.
So does Tolkien see himself in Bjorn at all?
I mean, do you think? I don't know if he really sees himself, but he's just, like, I think he can't contain the... His love of nature. I think it's starting to pour out here, because he really did. He specifically loved trees. We'll get tons of examples of that within this book itself, or within these books. Yeah. One example too. When Tolkien got older, all like the countryside that he loved as a kid, either became like farmland or worse, like industrialized to the point where when he was really old and he couldn't even drive himself anywhere, he would have other people drive, basically taxi him around. But if there was a new road built on the countryside, he would just tell him, no, you're not allowed to use this. Like, I refuse to go down this road. Because, it's just, like, insulting and disgusting to see, basically.
Okay, so he's pretty nostalgic for an earlier memory of this part of England he grew up in.
He was.
Am I taking it too far to say that, like, we see parallels with that, with Bjorn has this kind of lovely, wild estate, and it's being threatened by the goblins and the wargs slowly expanding eastward, and men from the south slowly expanding north, like we were talking about in the last chapter? Or you think Bjorn's safe from that?
I don't know. You got to explain to me more what you think about. In one of your questions, you're saying it's an oasis amid dark places here. Because, I mean, I personally... Yeah, his house seemed very protected, and... The house seemed very protected, and it was... it was definitely like an oasis kind of thing, and like a magical place to be with all these animals serving you and everything like that, which it was just cool. But the rest of it around it just seemed wild. Yeah, there was like a off distance threat of goblins attacking him, and you know, Bjorn had a personal hatred of him too, because it seemed like the goblins kicked him out of the mountains almost at one point.
Right. I mean, I got the impression that Bjorn, like we heard a little bit when Gandalf was talking about him and speculating where Bjorn was from, that Bjorn had been chased there, and he's wedged in between the mountains where the goblins are taking over and are bad for obvious reasons. And then Mirkwood, which we've heard a few allusions to and sounds like a generally dark and scary place. And Buren himself says, when they're talking about trust, which we'll get back to in a little bit, that you wouldn't trust anyone either if you lived where I do.
Going back to what you said in, yeah, it must have been the last episode. I mean, they're on the frontier. You know, life's not supposed to be easy or hard. I mean, obviously we know about we don't know about the dangerous forest, but we keep hearing allusions to it. And we know how dangerous the mountains are. But, I mean, he's in between them. He's not really actually in either.
But even so, even if it is just a frontier, he's pretty well established. Like, it still does feel like an oasis.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pretty able-bodied creature to protect what's his own, I guess.
I suppose so. And then, yeah, I mean, the milk and honey also reinforces that for me. Milk and honey is, in multiple religions, the, like, equivocated with paradise.
Yeah. Did it say milk? Because I was thinking about that this morning, too, but I was wondering.
Oh, I'm almost positive. I think there was a, he referenced it quite literally. He said, like, milk and honey.
I thought it was bread and honey. I don't know.
They were eating bread and honey, but.
Okay, it literally did say milk and honey?
I'm pretty sure, but I want to check now to make sure. Definitely clotted cream. So he's definitely milking some cows.
Okay.
Well, anyways.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing as you on that, though.
Okay. So that might be maybe it's just simply a redeeming, reassuring place. Kind of like the last homely home where Bilbo is recharged before he enters chaos again.
Indeed. I think, Tolkien's pretty good with all these rest stops. We've already seen in this book with Bilbo's house, basically, in chapter one, even though we weren't resting, the dwarves and Gandalf were resting there. And then we saw it again in Rivendell, and now we're seeing it here.
It is interesting to me, though, that all those places, although they all have different descriptions and feel like different places that I would love to see, and Tolkien describes them well, all of them are, like, they're not really tempered at all. All of them are just amazing, like, close to perfect. Yeah. You know? It's not like we've got a mediocre, pretty good place to stay. It's like, here's a bunch of terrible things, and then here's, like, the nicest accommodations you could imagine in this situation.
I'd hold off a little bit on Bjorn's, because it's...
it's too weird.
Yeah, the animals serving you. I mean, it's cool, but it's weird that animals are serving you, and then...
yeah, I guess he does make a point of...
there's no meat either to, you know, eat. If I was hungry, I'd definitely... I wouldn't want just bread and honey.
Well, you're not a bear.
Yeah, I guess.
So, speaking of the bread and honey, what do we make of Bjorn feeding these people? He was super hesitant at first. Like, Gandalf kind of plays a trick on him, basically.
To let him in.
To get a crew of 15, I suppose, through the door without being refused. And so we get the sense that Bjorn might have rejected them outright, but eventually accepts them and respects them and takes care of them. So he's certainly compassionate but hesitant. What can we take away from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this gets back kind of to, we've touched on it at some point, the tradition and myths, I think specifically Greek myth, but then also maybe in Norse myths too, where you like welcome the strangers, like the hospitality tradition of, yeah, you welcome strangers and everybody into your door and like you supply them and help them out. It seemed like originally Bjorn was almost kind of like, he kind of reminded me of Odysseus and the Cyclops almost, because Odysseus and his gang went there originally to get help, but then the outcome was totally different because the Cyclops was not going to help them. He was actually just going to eat them instead, and then Odysseus had to save them and get out, whereas Bjorn doesn't trust him at all at first, and he's like not the traditional host, but you know, we kind of see why like a mythology like that's kind of necessary. From the dwarves.
So explain what you mean. Like, why the Greeks are always welcoming strangers in the door, because they're motivated to do so, right?
If you look at it from the dwarves and Gandalf and Bilbo's perspective in this, it's the eagles dropped them off, which was nice, but they don't have any supplies whatsoever, and they got to go. You know, the goblins are, yeah, they're not in any immediate danger, but that threat is still out there, which Bjorn confirms for them too. I mean, like, how are they supposed to do the rest of their journey just on foot with, like, nothing to eat? I mean...
Mm-hmm. So they're pretty desperate.
Well, so, like, hospitality like this, in this story, it's very important to the actual person who's being hosted at all times throughout history, really.
So is, at the end of the day, though, is Bjorn doing this out of compassion? Has he been completely fooled, and then he's doing it because he also hates goblins?
Well, that was kind of my question to you, is just what you make of Bjorn's trust... or lack of throughout this whole chapter with this, with the,
well, people. I guess I would say what you're talking about with the Greeks welcoming people is because their culture and their religion had kind of established that as a set of norms. Yeah. Like they had been all raised on the assumption that you welcome a stranger because it could be a god coming in.
Yeah, but on a practical level, it's like, yeah, the stranger probably needed it, which is why that was tradition was even developed.
Right, and because in those days, when people would go out on journeys, almost everybody at some point could expect to find themselves in a place where they have to walk into a stranger's house and ask for food and lodging, right? And so it's like a practical, if we all agree this is a good thing to do, you can kind of embed that into a religion or a culture.
And, well, I don't know. And so I thought Bjorn, he's kind of hoodwinked into bringing him in, but then when he found out, and, you know, he let them in really because the story was good, and the story was good to him because it was about killing goblins. And so, you know, he's like, all right, I could be friends with these people.
Uh-huh. I don't mean to be, like, intentionally political about this, but Bjorn strikes me as sort of a libertarian. In the sense that, like, he doesn't... Maybe he's skeptical at first because he doesn't necessarily need to follow the same norms of hospitality that your typical host would. Whereas, like, that kind of what we were saying with the Greeks, where it's in the best interest of any host to be a good host and welcome strangers, because the reverse might be true in the future where they're out on the road in need of help and they have to go into someone else's house. Bjorn, because of his strength and isolation, maybe is kind of like, I'm totally self-sufficient, I need no one else's help, and therefore I have no need to ask anyone else. I have no need to give anyone else help because I will never need to ask for someone's help.
Yeah.
Right? Like he's kind of recognizes his own isolation. So that could be an easy justification for me why he's not playing into the typical norms of hospitality at first. Even though he warms up.
But then
up
I think them. Both our question is, well, why do we think he does? Besides that he confirms
he seems pretty, he's pretty skeptical, and he goes totally out of his way, essentially just to verify the truth of the story. And then once he does, he decides these guys are good guys and comes back to help them and welcome them. But before that, he is pretty wary, I'd say. He never really warms up to them.
Yeah, but even when he does warm up to them too, then they're... He sets them on their way with a bunch of provisions and the ponies to ride out to Mirkwood, but he still follows them afterwards too. So it's, you know, I kind of took that as, well, he still doesn't completely trust them, even though he kind of made a point to say he did. Do you disagree? Uh-huh.
I don't necessarily disagree, but I thought, like, Gandalf made a point of saying when Bilbo mentioned he had seen the form of a bear, the shadow of a bear in the woods alongside them as they're on their way to Mirkwood from Bjorn's home, Gandalf says that he's looking after them, he's protecting them, as well as protecting his animals, which he loves. So I saw it as he's being dubious in a smart way. You know, like he's not about to be hoodwinked in any way, but he's also, it's kind of his sign of respect is keeping the eye on them for their own sake. You don't think so?
No.
You think he remains untrustworthy? Or untrusting,
I mean, I think I agree with that. I think, yeah, he was kind of just looking out for the ponies themselves.
So that takes us to an interesting point in the story. When they reach Mirkwood, they have to... Bilbo and the hobbits have to dismount and send their ponies on their way with Bjorn in the shadows, ambling back to his lodge, and also send Gandalf on his way. Because Gandalf all of a sudden says, hey, okay... You know, I'm dropping you off here at the start of this totally scary forest that I've warned you about and told you it's a terrible place. See ya. I'm going to go south. And, you know, he Gandalf basically makes it sound like it's almost guaranteed that something's going to go astray in Mirkwood. And then he casually rides away. So I would say the dwarves and Bilbo are rightly frustrated and disappointed. Like, all the good things they've got going for them have just turned around and left. What are you taking?
Well, so first of all, I can just tell you from in one of J.R. Tolkien's letters, he's talking about this scene. And when he was originally writing it, I mean, Gandalf's business south, maybe we could touch on what we think that is. But when he originally wrote the story, okay, he had no idea what it was. He just had to get Gandalf out of the story because he wanted the dwarves and Bilbo to kind of be on their own.
Okay, so it's important for the next chapter that Gandalf not be there.
Yeah, but then also, like, just within this story itself, in chapter one, Gandalf was making it pretty clear that this is the Thorin and the dwarves' job, and he's sending Bilbo with them to help him. He didn't really say he had ever signed up for the whole thing.
Fair. Yeah, he's there as an advisor and not a leader.
Gandalf's going south, we keep hearing... Gandalf's going south, and we've heard a couple references throughout the book about this necromancer guy.
Yeah, who is this? I mean, give me the background. We don't have to go into the movie at all, because as we know, the Hobbit movies aren't that good. But I know that they did make a big, big deal out of the necromancer.
Yeah, so... Right? I think, like, let's just go off what we said in this book. At one point, Gandalf and Thorin were talking, and Gandalf was saying, hey, this dragon Smaug is going to be way, like, you're going to have your hands full just with Smaug. Like, you don't need to get involved with trying to mess around with this necromancer guy, to Thorin.
Was that in reference to Moria?
I don't know. I think it was in the first chapter.
Was it?
They also had Moria references in the first chapter.
Okay, I got the sense it's at some point... Yeah, Thorin was kind of like, well, why don't we go to Moria or something, like, let's return to our heartlands and or our homeland, our original homeland. And Gandalf was kind of like, whoa there, cowboy, like, you've got your hands full with this dragon. You don't even need to be thinking about these other bad things in the world.
Yeah, and this is what he's talking about, like, this necromancer. Basically, Gandalf saying Smaug is going to be cupcake compared to him.
Okay, so sounds like,
yeah,
a pretty bad
whatever.
Dude.
He or it is, yeah.
Okay.
What are necromancers in real life, though? I mean, we could kind of go with that.
Necro means death, and mancer, I would say, has to do something with... I would assume, like, something about bringing someone back from the dead.
Let's do some live research here. A person who practices necromancy, a wizard or magician. Well, that doesn't help us.
Communication with the dead. Summoning their spirit. So I will point out, this is one of those things that when you search... The entire Wikipedia article is not about Lord of the Rings. It's about the long tradition and etymology of necromancy and how it's practiced throughout time. So here, as we can assume, because it's a Latin word, Tolkien is directly referencing basically like something that's out there in the world that's been talked about. This is not an invented
concept. Yeah, but this one's the
right
necromancer with a capital N.
Right, so it's certainly an invented character, but we can assume... based on the name that this character is doing something with the dead.
I mean, then that's not a foreign concept. We've seen him like take a fairy tale thing and make it his own as throughout this book already with goblins and elves.
So do we get any other juicy tidbits about the necromancer, or we'll have to wait and see?
Gonna have to kind of wait and see. We just know it's a bigger deal. And if it's a bigger deal, I guess it makes sense that Gandalf would have to leave an important mission like defeating a dragon. So,
But is Gandalf just going to go off and fight this?
I don't know.
Bad,
is Bilbo just
going
to go off and kill this dragon and steal the gold?
Well, maybe.
Who knows?
Okay, and then Mirkwood is the other scary part of this whole thing. It's butted up against Bjorn's property. Bjorn gives them a bunch of warnings, like, don't look back, follow the path, don't leave the path. I'm sorry, not don't look back. It makes me think of numerous stories where, you know, don't look back or you'll be cursed type things. So what do we know about Mirkwood so far? This is a smack dab in the middle of the big map we've gotten at the beginning of the book, right?
So on the other side of it, if we look at the map, is the Lonely Mountain. But to get there, it's a big forest. I'm going to look at the map. All right. So we also know, too, Well, Bilbo asked, well, why don't we just go around it? And so Gandalf said, you know, you could go north, but it'll take you way longer. And then that's not safe either, because if you look at the map, you see those gray mountains. Yeah. What?
I believe he says that they're overflowing with goblins, hobgoblins, and orcs of all kinds.
Yes. I have no idea what a hobgoblin is. I assume it's not a cross between a goblin and a hobbit.
No, I'm getting, but hobgoblin means like a smaller goblin, right?
Yeah, maybe. Okay.
I feel like that's like an old English diminutive.
I thought it was just like a kooky thing.
I'm guessing it's a less badass goblin, is the general implication.
All right, so that was out, because, you know, we've already dealt enough with goblins, I'd say. And then far south, well, that's towards the Necromancer. Which Gandalf, I think, said even Bilbo has kind of heard of his power or something. There's some sort of reference there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I don't... You know, plus we're on the time crunch. We don't know when Durin's Day is, us two, because we haven't figured that out yet. But...
Some complex astrology.
But, you know, sometime in late fall is what we're thinking. So...
Okay.
I don't think we got time to just walk hundreds and hundreds of miles south and up and around. Especially if that way is not even safe either.
Okay, so Mirkwood is not a good option, but it's the best option.
Yeah, so he got Mirkwood from a couple of references throughout.
Without doing any etymology, I'll throw in my two bits that it sounds to me like Mirkwood sounds murky, aka dark and dirty and scary.
Yeah, that's about what it's going to be.
I know it's spelled differently, but...
So Mirkwood comes from some references in some Eddic poems. So Eddic, Edda. We're going back to Norse stuff again.
Okay.
And the forest would have been called Mirkwirth. And it had to have been associated with Germans and stuff, because sometimes it's associated in stories of Attila the Hun, who was, like, way back in, like... Basically, like the fall of Rome times, like on the edge of when the medieval times would have started, for people that are historically challenged.
The Goths,
yes, the Goths for sure.
The Vandals riding into Rome to destroy it from the north.
Yeah, the Goths, the Huns, the Vandals. That's where all these people are from.
I'm sorry, I missed part of that. They're from.
I mean, references to Mirkwood. They're in there, and then they're in these Eddic poems, and they must all came from the same place. And so it all talks about some forest. Splendid forest. Yeah, some splendid forest in the east between the mountains and the steppe.
Interesting.
And so when they say mountains and the steppe and forest in the east, that first of all matches our map in The Hobbit. But then this would also, if we're talking Huns or something, maybe this forest is in Germany. We were talking before, you thought it was something in Poland.
Yeah, I would, that's what I'm putting my money on, is something akin to the Bielowieza forest in Poland and Lithuania.
Yeah.
Which is supposedly the last bit of what was once an epic primeval forest that stretched across most of Europe.
Yeah, so there would be mountains in Western Europe. Maybe that's the Alps. Maybe that's like whatever's in the Balkans. I don't know.
Further towards Ukraine or something.
Yeah, some mountains in, Alps, Balkans, something in Germany. But then... On the east side of the forest is the steppe, which is like probably the plains of Russia, is what you could kind of assume. So anyways, in all these stories, the forest is, any references to it, the forest is always just alluded to as something that's in the way. Nobody really knows what's in there. Nobody has like a clear path through it, but it just seems like a dark and foreboding place that you don't want to enter, but you have to get through. But it's like completely an obstacle. Mm-hmm. Nobody would actually journey there as a destination, basically. It's just something you got to do to get to the other side.
Yeah.
Far as like a description of it in this book or throughout, well, you know, we don't really have a description of it in like history stuff. This is one of those times where he's probably just writing it into his story so that he can actually make a description for it based off the real references that he never had.
Mm-hmm. This is a bit of a diversion, but I would encourage for further reading on the, I would say, the mythology and cultural history to forests in Europe. And their relationship to Germany, Poland, Rome, throughout history. There's a really cool book called Landscape and Memory by Simon Schama. It's technically art history, but he delves into basically the mythology behind landscapes. And the big part of the beginning is about forests in Europe and how that's like tied into the psyche of modern cultures.
Maybe Clifford will get me that book for Christmas.
Maybe so.
Let's see. Did we talk enough about Gandalf actually leaving, though? I don't think we did.
No, not necessarily. We talked a bit about Mirkwood. We talked about where Gandalf is going.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's actually talk about Gandalf, yeah. Well, how do you feel now that he's going to go?
I'm pretty disappointed, of course. He seems like a critical... Like, when Gandalf is there, things are going well. And when Gandalf's not there, shit usually hits the fan. So, it doesn't seem like a good thing. That said, maybe it makes things more exciting.
Yeah.
As a rule, anytime Gandalf disappears, things start going downhill really quickly.
Yeah, and so he, like, told him to stay on this path. Like, that's his one directive, because if you get off it, there's, like, no chance you'll ever find it again, too. I mean...
Yeah, and Bjorn said the same thing. So they've hammered the point home that you should not leave the path in Mirkwood.
The case has been made that Gandalf just has more important business that he has to do. Like, has to handle it. He has to leave. Mm-hmm. That's that, period. So it's like, okay, I guess I can buy that, but... They're pretty screwed here. But it seems like Gandalf, you know, and Gandalf's saying that, all right, there's tons of danger coming up, but he's pretty like, I think they'll make it through, you know?
Yeah, he's pretty casually optimistic and ominous. It's like he knows something's going to go wrong, but he knows it's going to be okay is the impression I get from him.
It seems like, I would say he's kind of, luck's been a theme throughout this book. Mm-hmm. I would just kind of, though it wasn't stated, I would just kind of assume Gandalf's kind of just... trust to ride out his good luck for them even if he's not there, or like trust mm-hmm. trust that what needs to happen is gonna happen even if mm-hmm. even if there's dangers and adventures along the way, because I mean, yeah, he had to go, but like Gandalf probably didn't want to leave them,
right? Probably so. It does feel like maybe we talked a little bit about, I think last chapter or the chapter before that, about with this luck thing, what seems like very lucky coincidence or chance or something is, in a lot of cases, it feels like it could just be about intention. Like Bilbo, as soon as he has this like deep desire and intention to find his friends, he does. And it seems like, oh, he just happened to hear them at that instant. But if you look at it a little bit more broadly, maybe it's like as soon as he had this desire and it was like wholehearted and the only thing he was thinking about, it came to be.
Yeah.
So we could say maybe that's kind of what Gandalf is preparing them for with this forest, is like you have to be, your mind has to be in it. You have to be super committed and thinking about getting out of this forest, because if you go into this willy-nilly without the mindset of preparing, if you're not mentally prepared for it, you're never going to get out. But if you go in kind of expecting that you must get through in spite of any struggle, you will, even though there will be struggle.
Hmm. So you're thinking, what, he's like encouraging them?
I think he's kind of getting their heads ready for some challenges, some difficulties, but...
Because he can't be there himself to help them?
In part because he can't be there himself, but also it's like he's kind of cueing, like he's putting the desire in their minds, like this kind of single-minded desire to get through Mirkwood and get to the other side. And that desire alone, more so than anything Gandalf is going to do or not do, is actually what will get them through.
Yeah. Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Basically, it could be like a, like, if they're just along for the ride, even if Gandalf is there to direct them, they're not in a good place.
Yeah.
But if they're totally committed and obsessed with it, then Gandalf doesn't even have to be there because they're going to make it through on their own.
Okay.
That's my optimistic viewpoint for you.
Hmm. Well, I think it just it's a not a dark ending, but a cloudy ending, I'd say, to this chapter. Nobody's excited. We as readers we might be excited, but nobody's really excited for the next step of their journey.
Mm-hmm.
Should we leave it there?
I think so.
All right, cool. Short episode. Okay, so now, Clifford, we can talk about the song at the beginning that pumped us up, because it's before Christmas. It's going to be, what is tomorrow? Tomorrow is December 19th, so we're talking heavy Christmas preparation. Okay. So we were played in by the awesome intro of
Christmas in Killarney by Bing Crosby, the only version you should be listening to.
I think that's the only version that exists of that.
Yeah, probably so, but
this is the first episode we kind of get to try this thing. We're going to try to record the end of the episodes around when they're going to come out. So if you're still listening to this, there's no more content, obviously, from the chapter. If you're listening to this, you kind of just like our personalities.
To be honest. Maybe they're diligently following through.
Yeah, maybe.
Not pressing the skip button. True.
Anyways, all right. So how was your week, Clifford? Now you can give actual specific details.
It's not even that specific. In preparation for the holidays, things are getting very busy at work, so been working a lot, but getting pretty excited. Made some cookies, gonna make a gingerbread house, some molasses cookies. They're really good.
That sounds like a Clifford thing.
they're super gooey and tasty.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make a gingerbread house. Nice. If you remember, I do architecture, so It's kind of funny to do a gingerbread house because I'm required to mess with the design, but it's pretty darn hard to mess with the design out of the box. They make it pretty much you can't design it many other ways. So that should be fun.
Why don't you build an extension to the house?
I gotta bake some gingerbread if I want extra walls. How have you been?
Pretty good. Pretty good. I'm halfway through It's a Wonderful Life right now.
Okay, cool. One of my coworkers was just telling me that I absolutely have to watch that before Christmas this year.
You saying you haven't watched it ever?
I have not. That's correct.
Well, Clifford. All right, fun news too. So, just like a little heads up, for anybody that's listening to this week by week real time, next week's episode, probably going to be 2 days late, because we usually release these things on Wednesday, but Thursday of next week, Clifford and I will be reunited in person for the first time in about, 14 months?
Something like that.
Yeah, I think the last time we saw each other was Thanksgiving last year at the airport.
Whoa. Weird.
The Thursday of next week, we're having a big reunion party of all our cross-country friends from high school. Uh-huh. And so Clifford and I, before that, we'll do an episode. We'll do an episode, and then we'll record the ending for next week, hopefully. And then we'll come out Friday. Uh-huh. That's my goal. We'll see what really happens. But yeah, it should be pretty fun. Yeah, anyways, we originally stopped not doing the endings because we thought we'd have reviews to write out. To be perfectly frank, our audience isn't big enough right now, which is understandable. So that means two things.
Well, you could say they're not big enough, or they're just not writing enough reviews.
Correct. That means two things. We don't have enough reviews, which means that, one, it's very easy to get the coveted beer koozie that is so beloved. Second, we need your help, audience. Please spread the word mouth by mouth. If I know you know somebody that likes the movies, Lord of the Rings movies, and saw the Hobbit movies. Probably didn't like them, but they probably saw it, at least. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, so tell that person, there's probably at least 5 people you know. So, like, let's just make the general target of 5 people. Tell 5 people specifically who you know do not know about the show, and badger them to listen to it. We'll be eternally grateful, but then, like I said at the beginning of the show, I said, the goal of this show is for people that watched the movies, tried to read the books, but kind of struggled. Like, essentially, that's, like, in a nutshell, that's the audience we're going for. So, please reach out to those people so that they can hear this. I mean, Clifford and I, we enjoy doing this, but we're not really doing this because we like to hear ourselves talk or anything. Like, we're doing this because we want to just actually help people through these books because we think they're just amazing books and, everybody should read it. So that's kind of why.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I mean, we'll do all we can to promote this thing, but without spending hundreds of dollars, honestly, we can't do it without your help. So please, just get somebody to listen to it. Just One puts you in the positive. So just get one person to listen to it, 5 people, 10 people. Really depends how much you like this thing, but hopefully you do.
Yeah, I mean, pick a person, tell them about it.
Okay, cool. All right, well, Clifford, I will see you next week in person.
Yes, indeed.
To do this thing. Honestly, I don't think we actually know how to do it in person, but that'll be a fun part.
You'll have your mic on you?
I'll bring my mic home. You don't have to bring yours.
Okay, good, because I'm not planning to bring anything home.
That's a Clifford move. It's also a Patrick move to bring way too much home. Yeah. Okay, Clifford, have a good week, dude.
Yeah, you too. Enjoy.
All the fans as well. All right, thanks for listening, guys.
All right, thanks, y'all.
The holly green, the ivy green, the prettiest picture you've ever seen is Christmas in Killarney with all of the folks at home. It's nice to know to kiss your beau while cuddling under the mistletoe. And Santa Claus, you know, of course, is one of the boys from home. The door is always open, the neighbors pay a call, and Father John, before he's gone, will bless the house and all. How grand it feels to click your heels and join in the fun of the jigs and reels. I'm handing you no blarney, the likes you've never known. It's Christmas in Killarney with all of the folks at home.